This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio.
Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Find us wherever you get your podcasts from. Follow us on Facebook, on Instagram, on Twitter. Happy to have you guys here joining me today. We're about to come up on the holiday season now, and I know a lot of us are going to be getting around a table with our families, and I'd like you guys to really kind of think about what kind of future you might be leaving for your families, if there's a future for your families. As many of you know, if you've ever listened to me before, I'm an eco-socialist, and you've heard me say we have maybe 12 years to get off of fossil fuels, or else we'll suffer some of the worst effects of catastrophic climate change. And I've been called an alarmist for sure, but my guest today is someone who would say I'm probably a little bit too conservative in my estimates of that catastrophic climate change. I'd like to introduce Guy McPherson. Welcome to the show, Guy.
Thank you, Heather. It's a pleasure to chat today.
You're an emeritus professor from the University of Arizona, from the School of Natural Resources. You specialized in ecology, environmental biology. And how long have you been, were you a professor for?
I was at the University of Arizona for 20 years. I was a professor at Texas A&M for a year before that. I took a sabbatical leave at the University of California, Berkeley. I had honorary teaching appointments or visiting scholar appointments at Southern Utah University and Grinnell College. In between there, I worked for a year, took a one-year leave of absence from the university and worked for the Nature Conservancy in their home office in Arlington, Virginia. So I've been a lot of different places for a relatively short career in the academy.
And kind of what I wanted to focus in here with you is you are someone who likes to talk about a near-term extinction. Can you lay out what that is a little bit? Like, I know I'll talk about that climate change will eventually lead to human extinction, but I've never really put a date on it when I'm talking about it. So do you want to tell me a little bit about your dates that you come up with?
Yeah, you know, for a few years, I talked about abrupt climate change leading to human extinction in the same year that everybody today seems to be stuck on, 2100. And then the evidence accumulated. This goes back more than 10 years, by the way. And then the evidence began to accumulate, and it became obvious to me that there wouldn't be a human being on the planet long before then, because we'd run out of habitat long before then. So I moved, I shifted the date forward a bit. I said by 2050, and then I was talking about in the 2030s, and then I said by 2030. And at this point, I'd be shocked, and I have actually made this prediction that there will not be a human being on the planet in 2026. So sometime in 2025, because we're in the midst of the sixth mass extinction, because previous mass extinction events have precluded, for the most part, large complex organisms that rely upon thousands of other organisms for their survival. Because of all those things, and because we're in the midst of an abrupt heating event, I just don't see us persisting beyond 2025.
So that's pretty terrifying, because I'm out there saying, you know, we have maybe 12 years to change our ways before, you know, to prevent the worst of it. And you're saying, you know, within a few years, it's already too late, essentially.
Right. Well, we have triggered several dozen self-reinforcing feedback loops, so-called positive feedbacks. I go through all those in an essay I stopped updating 2.5 years ago on my blog, GuyMcPherson.com. In addition, it has become clear within the last few years that civilization is a heat engine, no matter how it's powered, and due to a phenomenon called global dimming or the aerosol masking effect, if we turn off the heat engine of civilization, the planet warms up even faster, very, very abruptly, way too rapid for humans or most other large organisms to keep up. So that's been called the McPherson paradox, not by me, but by other people, that civilization is a heat engine, and if we turn it off, the planet heats up even faster. So that's the crux of the notion, is that civilization as we currently operate it, as particularly embedded by the disaster capitalism in the United States, is not working well for almost anybody or anything on the planet. And if we turn the switch or even significantly reduce industrial activity, we'll warm the planet so quickly that we won't be able to keep up. We'll lose habitat almost immediately when that happens.
Could you dive into that just a tiny bit? Like, I don't want to get too scientific here on the show, but just a tiny bit about why, even if we do get off of climate change or if we get off of fossil fuels, and why the planet would still heat up at that point in time. Now, I know we'll do basic that carbon has a very long half-life. So even if we stopped everything today, the planet would still be heating because the carbon doesn't just go away. But what else would make that happen?
Right. And in addition to that, there's approximately a 10-year lag between the emission of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and the maximum heating associated with those molecules of carbon dioxide. So the fossil fuels that we're burning today, the coal and natural gas and so on that we're burning today, won't have its maximal impact until 2028. So, and we have a pretty good idea how much heating that will cause. So that's the first factor that's going to contribute to our demise, is that we've already locked in heating of at least 0.3 degrees Celsius over the course of the next 10 years. And then because of a rapid feedback associated with the moistening of the upper troposphere, where most of the moisture on the planet goes to hang out and then reinforces the heating from fossil fuels, we've locked in another 0.3 degrees C. So we've locked in 0.6 C if we stop right now. And that doesn't include the aerosol masking effect. I'll explain that as quickly as I can while still being relatively comprehensive. At the same time, industrial activity produces greenhouse gases that most of us know about that serve as something of a blanket to hold the heat down. The radiation comes in, strikes the Earth, warms up the planet, and the long wave radiation then can't escape because of greenhouse gases. We're throwing blankets on the bed and it's already too hot. Same time that our industrialization produces greenhouse gases, it also produces aerosols, thus the name aerosol masking effect. And those aerosols go up into the atmosphere and prevent the sunlight from ever getting to the Earth to begin with. So at the same time we're putting blankets on, we're also putting up umbrellas to protect the bed we're lying in, that bounce the incoming solar radiation away before it even manages to heat up the planet. If with as little as a 35% reduction in industrial activity, those aerosols fall out of the atmosphere in about 6 weeks and warm the planet 1 degree Celsius. That's huge. That takes us well beyond the point at which humans have persisted on this planet before. Homo sapiens has been here only up to the temperature we're at now, according to a paper by James Hansen and colleagues in 2017. And we're talking about a very, very rapid rate of change, a considerable increase in global average temperature in a period of 6 weeks or so. There's just no way that habitat for humans survives at that point with such a rapid heat up. The trees will all die, the complex organisms will all die, the soils will change profoundly. You think that we're seeing fires and floods now. With that kind of rapid heating, that's catastrophe. That is absolute catastrophe, and I don't see any way for humans to survive unless they have a bunch of stored food and water and staying in a bunker and not near a nuclear power plant that's about to melt down and so on. So that's the short version of the story.
Oh, I think you explained that really well. It definitely, I understand that as much damage as we're doing, we're hiding the effects of how much damage we're actually doing. And once that turns
around. That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's hiding. That's a great word for it that I hadn't thought of before.
So that's definitely terrifying and demoralizing. And is there anything we can do to prevent this or at least ameliorate some of the worst effects?
Well, there are many things we can do in our personal lives to ameliorate the suffering to come. Is there anything we can do as a society? No. When I realized that civilization was a heat engine, I almost immediately opted out. I moved to the wilds of southern rural New Mexico and built a homestead with a well-insulated straw bale house. I had two solar pumps and a hand pump. I was harvesting rainwater off the roofs. I was growing all my own food. This is an enormous challenge for somebody who had been in the academy their entire life. Suddenly, I'm trying to grow food and build structures and raise small animals and so on to feed myself and others. And that was 10 years ago or so. And then after that, papers came out on the aerosol masking effect. And it became clear that if everybody joined me in my quest to opt out of this set of living arrangements, then we would die even faster. We would lose habitat for humans even faster. So I was so disappointed that nobody followed me in my walk away from this set of living arrangements. And had everybody done that, I don't think there'd be a human being on the planet today.
Wow.
So it's a good thing people don't listen to me. That's what I'm saying.
All right. Well, I guess that's the end of the interview. Thank you for joining me today. No, I'm kidding. But I've actually had this question from friends of mine since I've kind of, I don't know, declared myself an environmental activist. And, you know, people come to me with questions of where is the best place to ride out and try to survive, as it were. And I'm like, I don't really have the answer for that, but it's a good question. But, you know, I'm just going to keep focusing on trying to change things. But where would you suggest people go?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I began getting that question probably 6 years ago when I first started talking about this. And because we knew relatively little about the aerosol masking effect, and because I knew very little about the coming catastrophic meltdown of the world's 450 nuclear power facilities, I recommended that people go far south, as close to Antarctica as you could. So Steve Wozniak, one of the co-founders of Apple Computers, the guy who single-handedly built the Apple I and Apple II computers, sent me an email message a month after my first public presentation, and he says, hey, I'm going to move to the south like you recommend. And then 2 years later, he moved to the southern island state of Australia, Tasmania, in a village there. And over time, it became clear to me that there was no better place to go because of the radical impact of the aerosol masking effect, of global dimming. And so if we even reduce industrial activity by as little as 35%, as I already indicated, that's going to warm the planet profoundly everywhere. And everywhere is characterized by this delicate balance between soil organisms, above ground organisms, and habitat for animals that live there. That includes human animals as well. So at this point, I don't think there's any better place to go. I do. I think the best place to go is not a geographic location. I think it's to go into your heart and act like a decent human being. And if that means opting out of or pushing back against the system that's driving us to extinction, I'm a huge fan. I've been a huge fan for a long time. So I don't think there's a physical location beyond one that gives you peace, beyond one that allows you to live fully and gratefully every day. Beyond that, you know, I wouldn't want to be in Manhattan, for example, or Los Angeles when the food stops showing up in the grocery stores. But on the other hand, I just moved from the jungle in Belize, where I'd been living for 27 months, and into a much more populated area, into a county that has nearly three times as many as the entire country of Belize, Westchester County, New York. And yeah, at least in my mind, I've convinced myself that because of what I know and because I've integrated it over a long period of time, I will be able to stave off suffering, because suffering is between the ears. Pain is something that we all experience, obviously. But with proper meditation, with proper mentality, with proper psychology, one need not suffer unnecessarily. So I have convinced, at least myself, we'll see whether that's true or not, that I will suffer relatively little, even though I'm living in a pretty populated area. And again, you know, if I had my druthers, I would be living in a wilder place. But in the time we have left, I'm going to support the people I love by spending time where they want to spend time.
Wow. Yeah, that's very profound. I'm actually at a little bit of a loss for words now, and that's unusual for me.
Well, so you know,
slightly change, you know, what we're talking about, because I know you're very comfortable talking about how capitalism has gotten us here, that capitalism will never be the solution to this, that even though there is no solution, capitalism is causing more suffering. And if the goal is to ameliorate that suffering, then capitalism is certainly not the way to do that.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, you know, I've been blaming this set of living arrangements, which is commonly called civilization or civilization, and pointing out that any ism probably isn't going to help, with one exception, and that's anarchism. And probably I'm profoundly influenced because I've been an anarchist for most of my adult life. So, of course, I think that's a good idea.
So how did you get there? You know, people know I'm an eco-socialist, and I definitely support some of my local communist organizers. What was your evolution of becoming an anarchist?
Well, when I was a college student, when I was an undergraduate student, I started reading a lot of Edward Abbey. Edward Abbey is sometimes known as the desert anarchist. He spent most of his adult life in and around Tucson, Arizona. And one of my favorite lines of his is, quote, "Anarchism is not a romantic fable, but the hard-headed realization based on 5,000 years of experience that we cannot entrust the management of our lives to kings, priests, politicians, generals, and county commissioners," end quote. And so I've read all the books Abbey has written except for his first, which he tried to buy every copy of apparently and burn them all. Jonathan Troy, by his own admission, was not really stellar. And then I started reading the people that he was reading that influenced him, people like Wallace Stegner and P.B. Guthrie Jr. and the Tao Te Ching and so on. And that reading and being in a position, an academic position, for much of my adult life allowed me time to think. And so I started running my classrooms as anarchism, as classroom anarchism, where we actually take responsibility for ourselves and for our neighbors, where we actually try to learn together instead of the conventional sage on the stage approach, where the person at the front of the classroom knows everything and is just trickling it out to the other people in the class. I didn't operate that way at all. I just asked questions, Socratic-like. I would just show up in the classroom and the students would have the notes I would be teaching from the first day of class. And so I'd throw it on them, say, okay, you have my notes, you know what I'm gonna say, so I'm not gonna say it. What do you think about fill in the blank? What do you think about this? What do you think about that? What's your experience with, and so on. So my reading when I was a college student led to the way I taught when I was on the other side of the classroom. And I continue now that Edward Abbey is dead. Perhaps the person most profoundly influenced by Abbey and by Abbey's writing is a guy named Doug Peacock. They were friends. And so now I read as much as I can from Doug Peacock, who's also a personal friend of mine. So I'm attempting to follow Abbey's legacy in spending a lot of time outdoors and pushing back against the system in the form of a social critic, which is what he did for much of his life. So I take my lead from him and from Stegner and A.B. Guthrie Jr. and Doug Peacock, the people who influenced him and who he influenced as well.
That's interesting, yeah. And if you could, send me a link to all the authors you've been reading so I can include all that in the show notes, along with any of your information you want included in the show notes, obviously.
Sure.
You know, reading and educating is one of the goals of making a media outlet, trying to share and have a cooperative of knowledge, which is very important. I wish I'd had you as a professor when I was in school. It was definitely very different from my education experience.
Well, I learned a lot when I was in college, mostly how not to administer a classroom, how not to teach so that people will actually learn. As I used to say and write in my presentations, I used to be a classroom conservative. What that means is I would stand up there in front of the classroom and my notes would be transferred from my pages to the students' pages without passing through the brain of either of us. That's what a classroom conservative does, and that's what I did for a couple of years, and then I realized nobody's learning anything from this. This is insane. This is the way everybody does it that I've seen, and yet it's insane. It doesn't make any sense. So I changed that pretty much as quickly as I could within the context of still managing to draw a paycheck. And that's the trick.
And you really sort of embrace that. I know people like to say there is no exact human nature, but I think definitely curiosity is part of what made us evolve into being humans. Our current system, love it or hate it. So, you know, definitely encouraging that curiosity is something I really wanted to applaud you for. But that's more, we need more people like that.
Well, and another thing I did that was roundly criticized by my contemporaries, you know, all my courses were in science departments, conservation biology and natural resource management and vegetation management and fire ecology and so on. So they all fell under the umbrella of science courses. And in all of those classes, I required students to complete a significant piece of art or literature as a major part of their grade, because I was trying to influence people into living a whole holistic lives. Not like I had done for most of my life, where I was a specialist and everybody was expected to be a specialist. And you learn more and more about less and less until eventually I knew everything about nothing at all. And I didn't want my students to be like that. I wanted them to experience art. And to experience art, it helps to actually do some art yourself. You realize how challenging it is, and it exercises the other side of the brain to the extent that our brains are divided. And so, you know, I was doing these crazy things that students uniformly hated for the first 15 weeks of the semester. And then when it was done, they thanked me, and they, not one to my knowledge, ever went to the department head and apologized for all those horrible things they'd said about me early in the semester. But as nearly as I can tell, when it came to the end of the semester, students were appreciative, and I continue to hear from my students. I continue to hear from my students who have become college professors that they wonder what I would do. They come to a decision point, and they wonder, what would Guy McPherson do? And I think that's the best compliment I can be paid as a college teacher, is to have my students who are now college teachers wondering what I would do and how I would act when some situation arises in the classroom.
That definitely is a huge compliment. There's not a lot of my college teachers. And I mean, I started off as a marine biology student and ended up becoming a visual arts photography student. So it's only my visual arts teachers that I actually still keep any sort of contact with. All of my original marine biology teachers, I've lost all my contact with. So that's an interesting analysis I never actually thought about till right now. But I had another question for you, trying to go back to, you know, this has been an interesting diversion, back to, what do you think are possibly the three aspects of our current capitalist society that are causing the most suffering?
Well, I think the single most detrimental idea that anybody ever had, capitalism or otherwise, and it's particularly obvious with capitalism, is ownership. And as George Herbert Walker Bush pointed out so many years ago, the government is trying to promote an ownership society. Well, the idea that's being pushed here is not merely ownership, but ownership of specific things by specific people. And that has led directly, in my opinion, to the idea that we have four people on the planet now who own as much in material possessions as half the people on the planet. And when I first started learning about that idea, or at least talking about that idea. 10 years ago, it was 25 or 30 people who had the same wealth as half the people on the planet. And then it was 20, and then it was 15, and then it was 12, and then it was 10, and then it was 6, and then it was 5, and now it's 4 people on the planet have as much material wealth as half of the people on the planet. If that isn't symptomatic of something gone horribly awry, I don't know what is. When Jeff Bezos makes more money every single day than you and me and every listener of this podcast combined will ever make, I see that as something of a problem. So I think ownership tops my list of the ills of capitalism. Probably number two goes hand in hand with that, and that's the idea, the very idea of capital, and especially extending that idea of capital to non-human animals. Once we make what we call animals, which are really non-human animals, because humans are animals right. too, once we make that step to animals being capital, then we have formed not so much a relationship with those organisms, but we're calling them resources now. They become something to be exploited, not something to have a relationship with. So if the deer in your yard is meat on the hoof or an exhibition for a museum instead of a relative, then again, we're headed down that road that will lead and has led to utter catastrophe. What else? Well, I think probably the next one, I haven't thought about this much at all, so you'll have to excuse me if I'm doing some fuzzy things.
Perfectly fine. I like to ask questions that people aren't prepared for occasionally.
Sure. Probably the next one is the idea of a positive discount rate or a positive interest rate. I have a PhD minor in neoclassical economics, and it's just a given that when you take money and put it in the bank, say today, that when you go to the bank 5 years, 10 years, 20 years from now, it's just going to be more money than when you put it in. So one of the impacts that has is to devalue the future. The future is less valuable than today. And so the reward is to exploit as rapidly as we can. So if by discounting the money, and never mind the whole idea of the abstract that is money and the digits that represent it, or the funny colored pieces of paper that represent it, when you discount money in the future, that leads to exploitation in the here and now. So those are three off the cuff. I'll try not to think about it anymore because then I'd feel bad about what I said.
No, especially that last point that you made. I know I've made a very similar point a number of times that capitalism can never be sustainable because it requires that unlimited growth. And we can't just keep having unlimited growth. And we've only been able to sustain it because of that exploitation that, you know, we've been broadening out the net of who we exploit and how we exploit. So I think that that's a, you know, at least it's something I've come to that conclusion. So I'm glad a professor also has come to the same conclusions.
Well, you know, it was Edward Abbey again who said, growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of a cancer cell. And here we are, acting like cancer.
I have not heard that quote, but I'm immediately going to start using that. That is an excellent quote. So if people want to know more about your research and your writings and your predictions, where can they read your work? Do you have recent books?
Yeah, I don't have any recent books. I think my latest book is from 2015. My scholarly efforts have contributed to 14 books so far, including as compiler and editor, as well as author of those books or co-author. And you can find those and all of my other writing at guymcpherson.com. That'll take you to a website called Nature Bats Last, which is a baseball metaphor that at the time I thought was a good idea.
All right, can you explain that metaphor, Nature Bats Last?
Yeah, you know, the dominant paradigm has been very clever. We have managed to convert living forests, living ecosystems into bricks and mortar and boards to convince ourselves that we are truly advanced organisms, so that I can go 15 feet from where I sit right now, push up a little lever, and water will start coming through the tap, and it's relatively clean, clear water. And most people within this system have convinced themselves that the water actually comes from the tap. And the whole system is allowing us to reach that conclusion that the conveniences that we have all around us are a result of our cleverness, but really they're the result of co-opting the living planet. So we can have all these cool things, and I can walk to a coffee shop from here, and I don't even drink coffee. I can walk to a grocery store. It's a highly walkable community where I live, and I got water coming through the taps, and I have the most advanced medical care system in the history of the planet, and we're able to have this conversation because I'm on a so-called smartphone that's making me stupider every day. And all of those things are true. But in the end, nature bats last. In the end, we cannot co-opt the living planet indefinitely. In the end, growth for the sake of growth is the ideology of a cancer cell, and the cancer cells all die too. Nature bats last. Nature is going to make a comeback and put us in our place and make us realize that without Mother Nature, we got nothing. Without Mother Nature, we don't have the ability to have water through coming through the taps. We don't have the ability for me to go to a coffee shop and get a cup of tea. We don't have the walkable community because we don't have the bricks and the mortar and the boards that it takes to build the buildings and the highways and the entire infrastructure that allows us to conclude that we are really, really clever. Always bear in mind, and Brian Williams said this the other night in closing off on nightly news session on, I think it was MSNBC, he said, nature always bats last. And he's right about that. Nature always bats last.
So I think that might be a good takeaway to end this podcast on, of all of what you're surrounding yourself with is disassociating you from where it's actually coming. So possibly one of the best ways to get in touch with yourself and in touch with the planet and really see the effects we're having is to try to step away from that disassociation and really understand where all of our resources are coming from and what's being exploited to get there, be it people, be it animals, be it the earth itself. I think that's a good takeaway. Did you have any last words you wanted to contribute before we call it a day?
You know, had we acted like our predecessors, had we acted in relation with other organisms and the living planet generally, then I suspect we'd be in a very different place today. I suspect we wouldn't be having conversation about capitalism, socialism, anarchism. I suspect that we would just be living in nature and appreciating what we had, being grateful for that time, and not forever wanting more. And that it's that forever wanting more that lands us right exactly where we are, unfortunately. So, Heather, I very much appreciate the opportunity to chat today. Let's do it again sometime.
Definitely. I don't want to say it's been a pleasure because, you know, you've terrified me more beyond what I already was, and I was pretty terrified to begin with, but it's been enlightening, and I have enjoyed having the conversation with you. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
To my listeners, thank you for listening today. Hopefully you aren't too terrified and curled up into a little ball, that you still want to keep supporting New Jersey Revolution Radio. We need your help. These are not the kind of stories you're hearing on mainstream media. This is not probably an interview you're going to hear on CNN tonight, that the corporate media that controls the message does not want anything to change. But we want change here, and that's why we take no corporate money. All of our funding comes from small donations from you guys, our listeners, from the activist community we try to support. You can go onto our website, www.njrevolutionradio.com, click on the contribute button. We just had a great event in Montclair. We're looking to have another event in the beginning of January down here in South Jersey for the South Jersey people. Hope we'll see you there. Buy a mug. We have the Capitalist Tears mugs, and we also have the What the Fuck mugs now. Soon the Wine Women and Revolution mugs will also be available. And thank you for listening. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.